The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, a few years ago, my wife and I went to a wedding reception, and it was one of those receptions where you sort of didn't know anyone, so you just went, hey, and they do the same, they go, hey, to you. And after a while, I said, hey, it's time to find our table, and I thought, we don't really know the couple that well, so really, we're going to be on table 25. So we look at table 25, and our names weren't there. I thought, whoa, hello, maybe we're table 24, and our names weren't there. I thought, hello, maybe we're table 23, and our names weren't there. And so we kept going until we got to table 2, and our names weren't there. I thought, hello, maybe we're on the head table, table number 1, and our names weren't there. So my wife goes, did you RSVP? And I said, yes, but they mustn't have got it. And I said, let's get out of here, because when the married couple come, this is going to be awkward. And when we left, we saw this sign saying, congratulations on the wedding of Michael and Helen. And I thought, hang on, we're meant to be at the reception of Michelle and Kevin. We had gone to the wrong wedding reception. So there are many things we get wrong in life, but imagine being wrong about what it means to be a Christian. And today, Paul is going to show us 3 myths that we, especially Christians, might have about what it means to be a Christian, and he will debunk them in his letter to the Philippians. So the first myth is this. Myth number 1 is God will give me a Ferrari. The myth goes, if I follow Jesus, Jesus will notice and he will bless me and he will give me a Ferrari. Now, of course, we're not so naive or crass, but maybe more subtly we might think, well, maybe Jesus might cure my parents of cancer. Maybe Jesus might fix my marriage. Maybe Jesus might cure me of diabetes, asthma, or depression. And there are good things to hope for, and I hope that Jesus, in his mercy, might answer those prayers, but there's no guarantee he will. And Paul debunks this myth, verse 29, by saying it's the opposite. For it has been granted, it has been guaranteed to you on behalf of Christ, not only to believe in him, but also to suffer for him. We are guaranteed a journey of suffering when we choose to follow Jesus. Last week you heard how I play rugby, because I went to a high school where rugby was compulsory. The only way you could get out of rugby is if you had a note from your doctor saying you're too weak to play rugby, or sick, or you had a disease. And somehow every Asian managed to get a letter from their doctor saying they could not play rugby. My Asian cousin went to school where rugby was compulsory, and when he played, his mother would be in the sideline yelling at him, run away! Don't get the ball! Run away! Just think, you Caucasian Australians, when you play sport, your parents are yelling, get in there! Hit him! What's wrong with you? But Asian parents are saying, run away! That's because Asians don't understand collision sports. Why would you play a contact sport? You're only guaranteed to get hurt. A concussion, a broken bone, stitches. Much safer to play chess or ping pong or Minecraft. And Paul says when we chose to follow Jesus, we chose a collision contact sport. No note from the doctor. We are guaranteed to suffer. It has been granted to you on behalf of Christ, not only to believe in him, but also to suffer for him. Jesus had a journey to glory, yes, but it was a journey through suffering. And we have the same journey to glory, yes, but a journey through suffering. Now, we don't know why God allows suffering. And if we try to guess, often we will be insensitive and wrong and damaging. But the Bible gives hints that God has a wisdom, a purpose in what he does. Stephen Bidoff, in his book on manhood, says the great figures of human history, for example, Nelson Mandela, Martin Luther King, Mahatma Gandhi, do you notice all these great figures had a life of suffering? Somehow their greatness was only possible because of a life of suffering. And somehow our glory will also be a journey through suffering. There's a purpose in our suffering. Last week I quoted to you an author called Viktor Frankl, Holocaust survivor, His book is called Man's Search for Meaning. Viktor Frankl is also a psychiatrist, and he says, imagine two hypothetical cases. Case number one is a woman who has to raise her child who has profound disabilities. Case number two is a woman who is just blessed. She's beautiful, she has money, she just goes to parties all her life. Well, at the end of their lives, this woman will be able to say, look at my life. I raised a child with disabilities. It will be very fulfilled. Whereas this woman will have to say, well, look at my life. What did I do? I just flirted with men. I went to parties. I always had money. What was the point of that? This will be empty and unfulfilling, a life of pleasure, where somehow suffering provides purpose. That's Viktor Frankl's point. And the same with us. Somehow our journey to glory is also a journey through suffering. So that's a first myth, that God will give us a Ferrari. Paul debunks it. No, we are guaranteed a journey of suffering. Myth number two, it's all about me. The myth says this, Jesus died for me. I am the most important person in his universe. It's all about me. And Paul says, no, it's not all about you. He debunks it. Verse 3, do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests. It's not all about you, but each of you to the interests of the others. In your relationships with one another, have the same mindset as Christ Jesus. Our example is Jesus. Well, what is this example? Well, Paul now gives the example with a very famous hymn from verse 6. Jesus, who being in very nature God, didn't consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God exalted him to the highest place, gave him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue acknowledge that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. Again, the example is Jesus. Yes, a journey to glory, but only through a path of humility. And the example is Jesus. God becomes a person, not just any person, but a slave, not just any slave, but a slave who dies, not just any death, but a death on a cross. Jesus humbles himself, puts our needs before his, and that was his journey to glory. And our journey to glory is the same. We humble ourselves and put the needs of others before our own. Now, for us Greek nerds, this is very exciting. There's a translation issue here in Philippians 2. In the Greek, they only give us two sentences, and we have to guess the relationship. The two sentences are this. Christ Jesus, sentence one, he was in the very nature God. Sentence number two, he did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage and made himself nothing. That's a second long sentence. We have to decide, is it although he was in the very nature God, he didn't consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage but made himself nothing? Or is it because he was in the very nature God, he did not consider equality with God? Now, to explain this, let's imagine the two sentences are these instead. Sam Chan is Asian. Sam Chan is short. So you have to decide, is it although I'm Asian in nature, I am short. So against my Asian nature, I'm short. Or is it because I'm Asian, according to my Asian nature, I'm short? Quick vote, who here thinks it's although, despite, against my Asian nature, I'm short? One person. Who here thinks, because, according, consistent with my Asian nature, I'm short? Wow, majority opinion. Wow, is it against his nature that Jesus makes himself nothing? Or is it because, according to his nature, he makes himself nothing? Most English translations, NIV included, go although, against, despite being God, he makes himself nothing. But Peter O'Brien, in his commentary, convincingly, I think, argues, it's because, in the context of the whole Bible storyline, this is how God acts. It's in his nature to humble himself for our sakes and put our needs before his own. And if we worship this same Jesus, We have His Spirit in us, and it's in our nature as well to humble ourselves and consider the needs of others before our own. We have three boys. The parenting books tell us you got to give them a choice. Do you want egg or do you want toast? That's how you make them happy. We have found it makes them the opposite. Just makes them selfish, self-entitled, and never happy with what they get. So we had time out, no choices, and now they're happy with what they get. Churches have the same thing. I'm all for contextualization, choices, but I think it might have had the negative, unintended effect. 8 a.m., traditional service. 10 a.m., family service. 5 p.m., contemporary service. You choose. You get a choice. And now no one's happy. The old people, the music's too loud. Families, they're not doing enough for our children. The contemporaries, the music's not loud enough. When really, we should just think, you know what? It's not about me. And maybe the older people can think, you know, the music's too loud, but it's making the young people happy. And that's what it's all about. The families might say, we still don't have a children's worker, but you know what? We spent the money on outreach instead. And that's what it's all about. The younger people might think, oh, there are too many hymns, but it's a love language of the older generation, and isn't that what it's all about, treating them with respect? So we should humble ourselves and consider the needs of others before our own, just like Jesus did, according to His nature. Myth number three, I can just let go and let God. Now I'm a Christian, now I follow Jesus, I can just relax and wait for Jesus to come again and set up His kingdom on earth. And Paul debunks it. He goes, no, verse 12, therefore, my dear friends, continue to work out your salvation with fear and trembling. There is work to do. Verse 13, why? For it is God who works in you to will and to act in order to fulfill His good purpose. Paul says, no, it's not let go, let God and do nothing. We have to work out our salvation. But we might think, isn't this salvation by works? I thought it was by grace, a gift from God. Well, yes, it is. It's still by grace, still a gift, because otherwise Paul would say work for your salvation, but he doesn't. He says work out our salvation, and he emphasizes because it's God who works in us. So it's still a gift from God, God doing the work. But we need to cooperate with God and work out our salvation with fear and trembling. I still remember when my wife gave birth to our first son, Toby, about 10 years ago now. It would be 10 years ago. And all our friends said, you've got to go to these birthing units, these newfangled birthing units. And so we did. But I didn't know what I'd sign up for. When we got there, there are no midwives helping you. There are no doctors. You're meant to do the work. It's a birthing unit. And so while my wife was in labor, I too was in labor running around helping her. I thought I could just turn up as a spectator and watch her do all the work. But I had work to do as well. I had to cooperate with her work. And let me just say, it's harder for the guy than it is for the girl, because women know what they're doing. But guys, we're still just making it up as we go, and no matter what we do, it will be the wrong thing. We are to cooperate with God's work in us. Well, let me give you an example of how this might look. A few years ago, a friend of mine got a payout from work so big, he paid off his house, bought a car, and took an overseas holiday. And part of me was sort of happy for him, but the other part of me was very envious. Like, God, what are you doing? Why him and not me? The Bible calls this envy sin. And the Bible says envy is the worst sin we can have. And it's the root of all evils. So I was guilty of envy. So how can I work out the envy from my life? How can I work out my salvation with fear and trembling? Well, again, by looking at God's work in my life. He's given me Jesus. I have His Spirit. I am His child. I have all the security and status and respect I need in God's eyes, so I should be happy and content with that and trust that even though He's not doing things the way I think He should, He has a wisdom and purpose in what He does, and I need to be content. And that's how I can work out the envy from my life and work out my salvation with fear and trembling. So do you remember our three myths today? Myth number one, God will give me a Ferrari. And Paul says, no, God will give us suffering. Our journey to glory goes through suffering. Myth number two, it's all about me. Paul says, no, It's all about putting the interests of others before our own. Humble ourselves as Jesus did. And myth number three, let go, let God. Paul says, no, work out our salvation with fear and trembling. So what does that mean for us today? Well, it means we need more of Jesus. That's what Paul is saying. So how can we have more of Jesus? Well, to illustrate, last year I talked about how a romantic, loving, committed relationship has three layers, just like a cheesecake has three layers. And so the first layer, using my relationship with my wife, we've been married for 20 years, is this. There should be romance in any loving, romantic relationship. That's the attraction, the electricity, the spark you get when you hold hands or kiss. But there's a middle layer, and that's companionship. That's where you're an item, a couple, and the language changes from she and I went to dinner to we language. We went to dinner. And you just hang out. You just enjoy hanging out on a Friday night watching TV together. And there needs to be commitment. Promises are made, vows, there's responsibilities, obligations, the understanding that this is exclusive and somewhat permanent. And psychologists say you need all three. If all you have is romance, that fades after 2 years. She's no longer attracted to you and you're not attracted to her after 2 years. It fades. So you've got to make sure companionship kicks in. But that by itself is not enough because that's just the friend zone. You're just hanging out. You're just buddies right now. So you need this one, commitment. But that by itself, well, that's just dry duty, obligation. You're just running a small business together. You're just business partners. You need all three. And we need all three in our relationship with Jesus. We need the romance, the first love we have with Jesus that he talks about in Revelation. And rediscover the wonder, the awe, the worship. See, once a week, my wife and I, to kindle the romance, we do date night. And the dynamic is I pretend I'm 18 again, trying to win her love for the first time. And we should do date night with Jesus. Just lose ourselves in the emotion, the wonder, the attraction, and the worship in songs, psalms, and hymns. Companionship. My wife and I check in with each other each day. What's making you happy? What's making you sad? What's making you angry? Tell me something about your day I don't know. And we do the same with Jesus. We tell him what's making us happy, sad, angry, something happening in our day. And then we ask Jesus, well, what's making you happy, sad, or angry right now? What's happening in your day? Check in with Jesus. Read the Bible. Have a prayer. Check in with him. And then commitment. My wife and I like to revisit our wedding vows. And often this happens when you go to a wedding and you hear the vows, you recommit to your own vows. And we too with Jesus, just go through the gospel again. Retell ourselves the gospel where God gave Jesus to us and committed himself to us. And we commit ourselves to Jesus as well. And there's the understanding that this is exclusive and permanent and safe. We need more of Jesus. Yes, so the question was, well, how can you rekindle the romance with God? And I think the parallel is my relationship with my wife. Like even date night, the jokes are, for married couples, it becomes a rut, a routine. And then so we got to remind ourselves, well, why are we doing it? What is the vision? What are the purpose? And just a mix up and go for something strange, surprising, unexpected and dangerous. And maybe it's the same with Jesus. I think every now and then we build in little, I call them rituals of disruption. So every now and then maybe we need to build in a little ritual of disruption. Maybe go on a short-term mission trip or sign up for a beach mission or be a volunteer at a crusader thing. And that's a ritual of disruption. And somehow I think that throws us enough that we rediscover the worship, the wonder, the awe. Or I think what I've done this year is just mix up the way I read the Bible. Last year, my minister would just text me at the start of each month a book of the Bible. And we'll both read it through as many times as we could for that month. I did that last year, but this year I'm using a Bible in 1 year program. And I think just mixing it up, reading the Psalms maybe. And I think, just listening to worship songs that you're not used to and not knowing what's coming next and just losing yourself in it. And just every now and then maybe go to a conference And I joke, I speak every now and then at a Katoomba conference for youth, and they have a mosh pit at the front. And I tell the leaders, you've got to get in the mosh pit. And that's your date night with Jesus, in the mosh pit. So maybe just do something disruptive, a bit different, just to just shake your equilibrium.
Yes, Craig. Yes. Yeah, I've got a question.
So okay.
For people here who aren't Christian.
Yes.
So you've basically said, if you're going to follow Jesus, it's going to involve suffering.
Yes.
Putting yourself down, humbling yourself.
Yes.
And working hard.
Yes.
What's the attraction in that?
What's the attraction? Well, what if that's just how we're wired? So like Viktor Frankl said, well, imagine the woman who had the charmed life. She actually ends it quite empty and unfulfilled. So Viktor Frankl says somehow, as humans, we are wired not to look for suffering, so that's wrong, but to understand that suffering is part of our context, and in the suffering there will be purpose. And I think that's just how we're wired. So last week, remember, I said, according to Aristotle, this is the secret to happiness. We've got to work out our nature, and once we've worked out our nature, we know what our purpose is. And once we live according to our purpose, we will be fulfilled. And that's a secret to what the Greek call eudaimonia, which is happiness and fulfillment. So what if according to our nature, we have the nature of Jesus, where our journey to glory is through suffering, it's through humility, putting the needs of others before us, because that's God's nature. So what if that's our own nature? And it's in trying to become more and more like Jesus, so becoming better than who we are right now. What if that's our nature? Well, that becomes our purpose, and if we live that way, we will be fulfilled. So somehow the attraction is, if we're living according to our nature, we will find happiness and fulfillment. And I think deep down we sense, yeah, there is something more to life than just atoms, molecules, and survival and chasing pleasure. So what if it's this instead?
Mm-hmm. To my mind, that's quite a radical idea compared mm-hmm. to what our society thinks.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that our society does all it can to yep. avoid suffering and to seek after pleasure.
Yes, that's right. I'll just listen to this lady called Amelia Pazanza. She was on a podcast for Invisibilia, and she thinks one of the reasons why she and her generation are so messed up, she says this: our parents, they were told, get a job, be successful, make some money, pay off a house. And we thought that was silly, but at least you know when you've done it. You know when you got the job, you got paid off the house, and you made some money. We got told you got to do whatever makes you happy. And then now we don't know. Have I done enough? Am I happy right now? Should I keep looking? Now am I happy? Should I keep doing something? Now am I happy? So now you're spiraling into this journey of introspection, morbid introspection, never knowing if you've done enough and if really you're happy. And so actually the irony is, by looking for happiness, we've made ourselves less happy, and more psychologists are now saying that. And that's part of why parents are so messed up, because we've been told you've got to do whatever makes your children happy. And according to Jennifer Senior, that is impossible. And by doing that, we've just made ourselves more stressed, more busy, more tired, and less happy. And that we've passed that on to the children now, more stressed, more tired, and less happy. When she says we should have been trying to make our children more virtuous, of better character. And it's interesting, one of my anaesthetists who I work with, his regret in life, now he's a parent, his kids are grown up, he says, because he was a doctor, I gave my children everything they wanted, and now I realise I shouldn't have. It just made them worse people, because they never went without. And so somehow we think by going without, we will be better people. But Jennifer Senior says, no, it's not giving your kids everything they ask for. Your project in life is to make them more virtuous. And maybe that's our project in life too, to become more like Jesus. And we saw that there. It's not all about me. It's about being humble and going through a journey of suffering, because that's the journey that Jesus had as well. Yeah, so in terms of suffering, cancer, which is awful, and so what does the Bible say about that? So the Bible, again, never really gives us the reason, but it asks us but it tells us how to survive. So doesn't give us the why, but gives us the how to survive. And that is by trusting that God has a loving reason behind what he does. And in the end, I explain, our choices are just this: either there is no God or there is a God. If there's no God, we're just atoms and molecules. So even something like cancer is just cells doing what cells do. But the fact that we cry out, this is a tragedy, this is wrong, this is a disease, it shouldn't be this way, means we know there should be a better way. But we can only know this if there is a good God who loves us, who made us, and that's why we sense there should be a better way. But if there's a good God who loves us and made us, now we've got to trust he has a good reason for suffering, even though we don't know what it is. And Timothy Keller says, and it must be such a good reason, even his own son had to suffer alongside with us. But we survive by knowing Jesus, trusting Jesus, and knowing there's another chapter still to come where God will wipe away all tears, right all wrongs. And by knowing Jesus, we know we can be in that final chapter to come.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.